text for making audiobook in MP3 of J.H. Brennan's Astral Doorways, 1971. Copy from online book on vk.com. Maybe some copy mistakes here, so alternative is to read on this, www.vk.com/doc13375874_324946638. Chapter 1 Understanding the Astral. The composite form of the Sphinx also represents by hieroglyphical analogy the four properties of the universal agent, that is to say, the astral light, dissolving, coagulating, heating and cooling. These four properties, directed by the will of man, can modify all phases of nature, producing life or death, health or disease, love or hatred, wealth even or poverty, in accordance with the given impulsion. It took me more than 10 years to find out what that meant. Occult grimoires are packed with references to the astral plane, or astral light, as Levi calls it, but lucid definitions are few and far between. The descriptions are tempting, although abhorred by the mystic, who sees it as a diversion from spiritual development. The astral plane holds many rewards for the magician. On it he will find the visions of time past and time to come. On it he will find the gods and the demons, the sylphs and the salamanders, the archangels and the elementals. On it he will find the secret of power, the key, as Levi intimates, to the production of miraculous effects on the physical plane. All this and more, provided he can reach the astral plane itself. At first, I thought of the astral plane as a parallel space-time continuum. The idea was heavily influenced by science fiction and, in retrospect, contained a germ of truth. But it was not the whole truth, not even a good approximation of the whole truth. Later, it seemed the plane must be time, considered as a fourth dimension. That idea came from Ouspensky, who argued that a three-dimensional creature operating in a two-dimensional world must produce miraculous effect. It might, for instance, escape from the walls of a square by stepping over them. From a two-dimensional viewpoint, with no conception of height, a miracle would have occurred. Perhaps then miracles in the three-dimensional world are simply manifestations of a fourth dimension, imperfectly experienced as time. Could this fourth dimension be the astral plane? I thought so for a while, but the descriptions never really added up. The use of the word astral in occult literature never really added up either. It became obvious that the term had more than one meaning. Muldoon's astral body, for instance, have no real connection with the astral plane. His meanderings had really taken place in the etheric body, which was something else again. It occurred to me eventually that the astral plane was not a place. One reason why magicians like Levi prefer the expression astral light. Yet thinking of the astral as a condition had its drawbacks too. All the descriptions seemed exactly like a place. In London, seeking a membership of an occult fraternity, I put the question to one I thought should know. He told me astral plane was an old term for the realm of the visual imagination. Years later, I was to say the same thing to a fellow student. She frowned and said it could not be, the answer was too simple. My own reaction was similar. To describe the astral plane as the stuff of daydreams seemed almost an insult to the grimoires. But my mentor was right and I was wrong. My problem was superficial understanding. Like most people, I equated imagination with unreality. Understanding is far from easy and I apologize in advance should some readers find the next few pages obscure. The remainder of the book is less so, I assure them. But it is based on the ideas I am about to give, so they will repay the little extra concentration now. I found the best way to approach the problem was first to analyze exactly where what we are. The exercise is seldom carried out. The average man himself without examination. He is a body and a mind. His ultimate nature is a mystery because he seldom feels the urge to think about it. Zen Buddhists in Japan and the Sufis of the Middle East pay more attention to the essential self. In preliminary training, a Sufi adept might place a lighted candle beneath your hand. What did I do then? He asks as you snatch your hand away. You burned me. But with oriental patience he will explain that he did not burn you. Because your body is not you, not the essential you. If the painful experiment is repeated, you might be tempted to reply that he burned your hand. But this, on reflection, is not true either. The hand is not a part of you, just something you can use. Although distinctly wearing on the pupil, this approach is useful. For it demonstrates in a dramatic way the possibility of arriving at the self by eliminating what the self is not. You are not, as we have seen, your body. That is merely some thing that carries you around, so forget it for the moment. Are you then a mind? This is closer, but not close enough. For mind can cover much more than the essential you. Thoughts, for instance, are a part of mind. Yet you are not your thoughts. They change every waking moment. You remain. Joyce showed it possible to observe the stream of consciousness. You are the observer, not the stream. You are not your emotions, although emotions may sometimes overwhelm you. Emotions are as transient as thoughts. The real you is not transient. You are not your memories. For these will fade, while you remain. You are not your personality. For your personality differs now from your personality at the age of 3. Yet the essential you remains. It is, in theory, possible to suffer from amnesia, blindness, deafness, lack of taste in touch and smell, to paralyze the body, stop the stream of consciousness and still remain yourself. Once you grasp this idea, you have come to a negative understanding of the essential self. A Zen master would go further, equating this persistent kernel with the all. But you are not yet ready for that step. You are, however, ready for a fresh understanding of your mind and your environment. You fear, in fact, be ready for a fresh look at the meaning of reality. But the dreadful earnestness of your position need not frighten you too much. I would refer you now to the diagram marked Fig 1, or see Fig on vk.com. Take the dividing line marked self as the essential you. To the right of that line extends the physical world, shaded to show its various gradations. First your body, the most immediate point of contact with the self. Then your immediate environment, perhaps the room in which you now sit reading. Next, an intermediate environment, still yours in a sense, your town, your country and the different countries you know at first hand. Beyond that the world, familiar only at second hand through books and travelers' tales. And beyond the world, the universe. To the left extends your mind. First your present personality, the inner mask on the essential self. Then your immediate area of awareness, the conscious thoughts and feelings. Next your personal subconscious, the Freudian reservoir of buried memories and experiences. Beyond that, the collective unconscious, a psychic expression of the basic brain, accessible only by means of symbols. And beyond that, the mind's antipodes. Both arms of the diagram are open, ended. Neither the totality of the universe nor the totality of the mind is known to man. A diagram like this has limitations. It cannot show, for instance, how mind appears to interpenetrate with matter. But it can express a basic truth, that self is poised between the worlds of matter and of mind and that both worlds are distinct and real. Examination of the picture shows your experience of the physical plane is strictly limited. So too, is your awareness of the mental realm. But techniques exist to extend inner awareness. That is what this book is all about. And that is where the astral plane comes in. Now please examine the diagram marked figure 2. The black area added to the basic diagram represents the astral plane. It extends from the self and touches all parts of the mind. Consider the area as a fluid medium, reacting to the psychic forces underneath. Thoughts become pictures. Abstractions become symbols. Emotions become the driving forces behind them. If you sprinkle fine sand on a metal plate and sound a note directly underneath, the sound waves produce patterns in the sand. The astral plane works in much the same way. But here it is psychic forces which build up the patterns. The most common form of astral operation is the day dream. Your immediate thoughts are brought alive, as a playwright's words come alive on stage. You see the thoughts as pictures, rather than hearing them as words. And you have a more or less conscious control of what is going on. But as you travel further into the astral, control becomes less secure. Unconscious forces shape the imaginary environment. symbols take on a life of their own. At the same time, the self gradually loses touch with the physical world. Awareness becomes increasingly confined to the astral words like travel and environment follow from the diagram. But this is not the only reason why they are used. Subjectively, an astral trip has all the earmarks of a journey. It is only from the outside that the plane appears a state of consciousness. Once awareness of the physical is lost, the inner landscape takes on reality tone, becomes environment in every sense of the word. The most familiar example of this is dreaming. Dreams are a function of the astral plane. They are memory rests, remainders from nightly experiences, says Rampe, as well as the Danish wise man Martinus. Our remark, their chaotic nature springs from the fact that discrimination and control are usually relaxed in sleep. The unconscious forces are allowed full play. Illogical associations produce illogical dramas. There is a subtle shade of difference between a sleeping dream and trance state vision. Trance vision can produce scenes just as bizarre as any dream. The fluid feel, with one scene melting into another, is often there as well. But in a vision, the subject recognizes the strangeness. In a dream, this is simply accepted. For years, I assumed everyone had access to the astral plane, even if they seldom went further than daydreaming. Then, to my utter astonishment, I discovered my wife could not make the simplest mental pictures. In view of this, there is a possibility that some readers may share her difficulty. Practice may solve the problem, it did for my wife. In the meantime, I had better mention that on the astral, other senses besides sight appear to function. Of these, sight seems the most widely developed. Next comes hearing, then taste, touch, and finally smell. Smell, for some reason, tends to be the least developed, and a number of people who experience quite vivid visions in other respects find this sense absent. Outside of trance, which usually calls for special techniques, the degree of reality tone varies from person to person. But here again, practice leads to a distinct improvement. In the next chapter, there are a few simple exercises which, with regular practice, will speed this improvement. Although many readers will not need them, for others they are the first step towards using the astral doorways. There is a warning printed on the first page of this book. By now you may be tempted to ignore it. Because by now you can see the astral plane is a level of the mind. Western culture being what it is, all in our worlds are thought of as somehow unreal. They are only imagination and really not worth bothering about. They are empty imagination, so they can't do any harm. This sort of attitude is a common mistake. It is also a very dangerous mistake if you intend to use the doorways. The astral plane is certainly imagination, but I would disagree strongly with that word only. The inner worlds are real by any reasonable definition. Your psyche exists as a fact of life. It can't be measured by physical instruments any more than the physical world can be examined through psychological techniques. But it is the dot you are aware of it. And you are influenced by it. It is the extent of this influence that makes the psyche so important. Its forces can produce an ulcer. Or, channeled into enthusiasm for work, produce money in the bank. These are things are too familiar to be impressive. But the picture becomes more dramatic when you consider the rise of Hitler. This insignificant, poorly educated little Wanam was dominated by inner forces. They drove him to take over most of Europe. Energies powerful enough to produce such effects deserve respect. Energy is the key word of the psyche. It is only on the astral plane that these energies take on form. But the transformation does not always mean a decrease of power. And that is something to be borne in mind. In practical terms, the first problem you will meet is fascination. A whole new world opens up beyond the doorways. You have a natural urge to explore it as fully as possible. It is big enough to bring you novelty on every trip. Acres of the real estate are yours, probably far more than you own in the physical world. So you can explore for years without once leaving your own demesne. All these factors add up to an interest which can easily get out of control. Your friends will note it their result before you do. They will say you have become moody or dreamy. They are right. For you are continually yielding to the temptation to wander on the astral plane. and while your attention is fixed there, physical plane function suffers. At best there is a decline in your efficiency. At worst you are knocked down by a bus. Because of this, astral journeys should be limited and, above all, clearly defined. You must set a beginning and an ending to each one. Set them distinctly and stick to them. There are routines associated with the use of the doorways which will help you here. Use them from the beginning. If you train yourself in good habits while working with the subjective astral, there is a lot less chance of trouble when you move into the objective, trance, sphere. But fascination is not the only danger. Any reader with experience of mental illness knows the strength of psychic forces. On some levels of the astral, these forces are met head-on. The effect on an unprepared personality can be staggering. Dream deaths have actually been recorded in the Philippines. With dangers like this, you might now ask why anyone should venture deep into the astral at all. You will find part of the answer in Hunt's famous observation about Everest, because it is there. You will find another part in Jung's writings about the creative imagination. This is a technique strikingly similar to some forms of astral working and one which leads to very considerable psychological benefits. And you will find a further part of the answer in the quotation which began this chapter. To the old French Magus Levi, the astral plane held out the promise of remarkable power over the physical world. Whether you believe that promise is a matter for yourself. By now you should have some idea what the astral plane is all about. But before preparing you for your first trip, I had better make some mention of the astral body. Earlier, I made the point that the astral and etheric bodies are often confused. This is not entirely a question of semantics, meaning of words. The real astral body can do most things the etheric can do, and a lot of things it cannot. That is to say, the astral body can function on the physical plane. Before going any further into this, I had better define my terms. The etheric body is something you are equipped with in the natural course of things. Although intangible, it belongs to the physical plane. It is sometimes described as being composed of finer matter. On this body in Martinus Cosmology see levetsivanta.dk/116.htm, other schools of thought hold it is a grid of force, possibly similar to electricity. It is a mirror image of your physical body and usually coincides with it. But in certain circumstances it can be projected out of the physical. When this happens, it can carry consciousness virtually anywhere on the physical plane. But it cannot carry you into the inner worlds any more than your body can walk into a dream. Your astral body, sometimes called desire body or body of light, is different. First, its natural home is the left arm of our diagram. Its component elements are mind, stuff. LTS form is what you make it, consciously or unconsciously. In other words, your desire body can be anything you desire. The only limitation is your talent for shaping the astral forces. Should this talent be lacking, it will tend to build itself in conformity with your inner nature. Frequently the results are startling. Often they are far from flattering. For the average man, the astral body is used only on the astral plane. But the trained occultist can use it on the physical as well. The nature of the astral body does not change. Rather it is superimposed on the physical world. The technique for doing this bears no relation to astral journeys or operation by the doorways. It is given later as a curiosity, but you will almost certainly find it extremely difficult to master. The doorways, as you will see, are easier. Chapter 2: A Pathway to the Doors. In the advertising business, many men and women are employed as visualizers. Such jobs are generally well paid. Most of those who hold them have a talent for design and graphics, but basically they earn their salaries through an ability to see clearly in their minds how a finished advertisement will look. With the exception of a few people like my wife, the ability to create mental pictures is widespread. Not so the ability to see them clearly. Most daydreams are fragile things. They are flat and hazy, like an out-of-focus photograph. Their colors are anemic pastels. This is a situation you will have to change if you want to make a reasonable exploration of the astral plane. Your mental pictures must become crisp and clear. Their colors must be vital and alive. And when this is achieved, you must go further. You must develop the ability to imagine sounds and smells, tastes and sensations. The better you can do this, the more rewarding will your trips become. It is also important to develop concentration. Use of the doorways calls for the ability to keep your mind fixed on one thing for a given time. The period is seldom short. So without concentration, the doorways remain closed. It is perfectly possible to develop concentration and visualization ability at the same time. Both tend to grow out of the exercise given in this chapter. But the ability to concentrate is such a worthwhile talent in every walk of life that I intend to give some hints on its separate development. Despite the fact that these are not directly related to astral operations, you will find it very useful to train yourself in these techniques before moving on to visualization exercises. You probably feel you concentrate quite well. A lot of people do. There is, however, a simple test to help you find out how you rate. Remember, concentration is the ability to keep your mind fixed on one thing to the exclusion of all other thoughts. Now try the test. Pick a comfortable chair in quiet surroundings where you are unlikely to be disturbed. Sit back, relax and close your eyes. Now mentally begin to count. You must do nothing else but count. Your whole attention must be on the numbers. Observe yourself very carefully as you try this test. The instant any outside thought comes into your mind, stop counting. How did you score? Unless you have a trained mind, the results of this test usually surprising. With most people, counting stops at 4 or 5. Only a few rare individuals can get as high as 10. Anything beyond 15 or 20 seems completely impossible. The most common trap is some thoughts such as, "This is too easy." But once the thought arises, you have stopped concentrating on your test. Another subtle trap arises with the thought, "How well I'm doing." If you avoided both, chances are you succumb to boredom. Your concentration was broken by the thought, "Well, this is a silly test anyway, I don't need to do it to prove I can concentrate." Yet the simple fact is, few people can concentrate fully even for 5 minutes at a time. If they could, the average score in this test would be well up in the hundreds. Oriental yogis develop the ability to hold one thought in their minds for hours on end. You will not need to go that far for present purposes. But unless your concentration is far above average for the West, you will have to do something about improving it before you can make much use of the doorways. A good way to start is to set aside a period for practice every day. This need not, and, in fact, should not be more than 15 minutes, but regularity of practice is absolutely vital. Concentration is a habit. The only way to develop a habit is to keep at it. It will help to form the habit if you practice at the same time every day. Try to fool yourself that this is impossible because of business or social commitments. Set the alarm clock 15 minutes earlier and use the time to practice. Better concentration will more than make up for the sleep you lose. There is another reason for choosing early morning to practice. Your mind will put up massive resistance to training. You will find yourself with a wealth of reasons why you should give your concentration period a miss just this one time. This resistance is a good deal harder to fight in the evening when you are tired than in the morning when you are fresh. And if you happen to be the first member of your family out of bed, there is obviously less chance that you will be disturbed by others. The same holds good for other sources of disturbance such as phone calls. Once you have settled on the time and place, your next step is to relax. Despite the common picture of straining intensity and furrowed brows, concentration comes easiest in a relaxed state. You are setting out on a mental exercise and want no distractions from your body. Foo, have a headache, take an aspirin. Foo, are uncomfortable, take time to get comfortable. Then let your muscles relax. Your body won't disturb you if it is limp. And afterwards you will finish the exercise feeling fresh. At first your best course is to take a subject and concentrate on the train or thought arising from it. Don't force anything. Hold the subject in your mind and let your thoughts revolve around it. This is a form of meditation and the information that arises can be useful in itself. You will soon find that, Like the counting test, this exercise is not nearly so easy as it sounds. Other thoughts creep in. Dister, Bance is a good. This happens to everyone at first and should not worry you. It is a sound idea to make a written note of each break in the train of thought as it occurs. A simple tick under headings such as mind wandering, noises and other breaks will do. Such a record gives you a basis for future comparison. It will mean you can tell at a glance how your concentration has improved as the weeks go by. Do not expect quick results. You are, to put it bluntly, in the same position as a fat and flabby businessman starting on a muscle building course. The mental muscles take just as much time to develop. But as the weeks go by, you will notice an improvement. Eventually you will be able to get through the entire 15-minute period with very few breaks, or none at all. At this stage, increase the time allowed to 20 minutes and move on to your first visualization exercise. It is best to start with something simple. For the first 2 weeks, stick to basic geometrical shapes such as a square, a circle or a triangle. Pick one, shut your eyes and try to picture it in your mind. Again, don't try to force yourself. And don't despair if things are slow at first. Try drawing the shape on a piece of paper beforehand and looking at it just before you close your eyes. Towards the end of the second week, when you have made some progress in visualizing single shapes, try visualizing two at once. For you did during your concentration exercises, make a note of any special difficulties. Again, these notes will be useful as a record of your progress. Keep working with this exercise each day until you are proficient. By this I mean that the mental picture of, let's say, the circle comes to you quickly, clearly and easily. It is important that you see only what you want to see. If the circle becomes distorted, moves about, increases or decreases in size, while you are watching it with your mental eye, then you have not yet obtained sufficient control of your mind. Should this exercise take more than a month of regular daily practice, it may be that you are one of those rare individuals who experience the most difficulty with simple shapes. In that case, the aim is to move on to the next exercise and return to the geometrical figures at a later date. Under no circumstances should you attempt to increase the 20-minute period. To do so will not mean faster progress. These exercises, simple as they are, represent your first deliberate contact with the astral plane. My earlier remarks about fascination are just as relevant now as they will be later. You will reap no benefits from driving yourself. Work regularly at your own rate. There is lots of time. Don't spend less than 2 weeks on any exercise, no matter how easy you find it. But don't worry if you have to spend more than 2 weeks, with some exercises much more. You can only develop in your own time and the results will be worth the wait. Your next exercise may seem a big step from simple geometrical figures. But there is every chance you will actually find it easier. This is partially because of the practice you had with the first exercise and partially because the new subject. Take a good look round the room. Then shut your eyes and try to visualize it. After a minute or so, open your eyes again and check on the accuracy of your mental picture. This exercise is tied in closely with your powers of observation. You may be very surprised at how much you will forget in the instant between closing your eyes and beginning to visualize. Now close your eyes and try again. It will probably be fairly easy, even at first, to visualize the broad outline. But you must try to do more than this. You must attempt to fill in the various details. Again, there is no need to hurry, no need to force yourself. The details will come in their own time. Initially, it will be enough to visualize just that part of the room you could see before you shut your eyes. Work at this until you have filled in the finer details, including colors. Once you have managed this, imagine yourself walking all around the room, noting detail as you go along. Spend a few of your exercise periods doing this in one direction, only. That is to say, imagine yourself starting in the door and circling the room in a clockwise direction until you are back at the door. Afterwards, check your visualization by doing the same thing physically. Getting the hang of this may take some time, but stick at it. Once the visualization has become strong and easy, try mentally moving round the room in the opposite direction.